My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform, and on behalf of Senator Cardin, Senator Blunt, and our board, I want to welcome you to today's program on the open enrollment season for Medicare. Open enrollment for 2016 will begin on October 15th. In case you hadn't noticed, that's tomorrow. and it runs until December 7th. During that period, you can switch and I put this in the second person, but I could put it in the first person. One can switch from original Medicare to one of the privately run Medicare Advantage plans, or vice versa. You can switch from one Medicare drug Part D plan to another, or drop your Part D coverage altogether, or find a Medicare Advantage plan that has it included. There are important and sometimes confusing choices that are facing more than 50 million Medicare beneficiaries, and it affects their health care spending. It affects the costs to the program overall. It affects access to the services that are needed. And the point of today's program is to educate ourselves on the basics of this open enrollment process and learn about the trends in this growing segment of the Medicare enrollment. We're joined in bringing you this program by the Kaiser Family Foundation, one of America's most trusted voices on health policy issues, a source for more good information about Medicare than almost anywhere else. A lot of it you'll find in your packets and in a couple of the items that were so fresh that they didn't even make it into the packets. We've got one of America's most distinguished Medicare experts, the Foundation's Senior Vice President, Tricia Newman, here to help referee the discussion this afternoon. Tricia, glad to have you back in the co-moderator chair. And why don't you start us off with a little scene setting?
All right. Well, thank you, Ed, and thanks, everybody, for being here for the open enrollment period discussion. We are particularly happy to be here talking. I think I need a little help getting to my slides. We're very happy to be talking about the open enrollment period. Notice the flashing lights that are so exciting. Because so few people are really focused on the Medicare open enrollment period. There's been a lot of discussion about the ACA open enrollment period, and that's obviously very important. But for the 55 million people who are on Medicare, the open enrollment period deserves our attention. And I can tell you, I'm saying that based on very personal experience, because I've been helping my favorite Medicare beneficiary, my mom, approach this open enrollment period. And what I can say is there are big differences across plans, and people will leave real money on the table if they don't look and they don't think about their options. And that's why we're here today, to talk about what are the issues, why should people think about the plans that are out there, and what choices are available and what they might do. So in terms of background, to save my fellow panelists some time so they don't have to go through this, what are the options? Well, with Medicare Advantage, these are private plans. They receive money from the federal government, from Medicare, to provide services under Medicare Parts A and B. Often these plans, like HMOs and PPOs, are also providing Medicare Part D coverage as well. These plans vary in lots of different ways: premiums, cost sharing, providers, their drug benefits. And all of those things can have important implications for consumers. Another set of options for people during the Medicare open enrollment period are Medicare drug plans. So these are standalone drug plans, prescription drug plans, that generally are for people in traditional Medicare. And people sign up for a plan to supplement what they have under traditional Medicare. As I said, Part D is offered exclusively by private plans, which means it's not integral to Medicare. You actually have to take action to enroll in another plan to get your Medicare-covered drug benefit. These Part D plans also differ in a number of different ways: premiums, cost-sharing, deductibles, what drugs are covered and on what tiers, and pharmacy networks. We're going to hear from Gretchen Jacobson on Medicare Advantage, and we're going to hear from Jack Hoadley on Part D, and we're all going to be a lot smarter in a few minutes. Each year during this open enrollment period, beneficiaries are encouraged to review their options, but I think what is fair to say is that very few do. We know that switching rates are very low, and we also have a good sense of why that's true. I think people have a sense that doesn't make much of a difference. It's too much trouble. Whatever it is, our agenda is here today is to talk about why it might make a difference for them. So just to make it a little bit more personal, this is not my mom. So you have people on traditional Medicare, and there are 39 million of them, and 24 million of them are in PDPs or the standalone plans. They have some decisions, as Ed said. They can decide to choose among the various PDPs, and there are 26 on average available. They can decide to switch from traditional Medicare to Medicare Advantage plans. These are the decisions they can make during this open enrollment period. Or they can make no change, and that's typically what we see. On the other side, you've got people in Medicare Advantage plans, some 17 million right now. Their first decision is, do they want to stick with their plan? Do they want to switch to another one? There are 19 options available on average. They can decide to switch from Medicare Advantage during this period to traditional Medicare. And if they do, they might want to choose a PDP, although they might not be able to get a Medigap plan. A story for another day, perhaps. Or they can make no change. That's what's happening during this period. Those are the issues that are available. In terms of consumers, there are a lot of things. If you ask consumers what matters to you, they're going to say, they're actually going to say everything matters. But in terms of what they can see initially, costs are obviously important. So premiums, that's an issue for traditional Medicare, Medicare Advantage, and Part D. Very visible, very easy to compare, but not the whole story. Deductibles and cost sharing, that's an issue for traditional Medicare, Medicare Advantage, and Part D. Out-of-network charges, in-network charges. Well, traditional Medicare doesn't really have that situation yet, but Medicare Advantage does, and so does Part D. Access to providers, that's a big deal. Can they have access to their physicians or hospitals or other providers? That's an issue for traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage. Pharmacy access is an issue for Medicare Advantage plans that cover Part D and Part D plans. Which medications are in their formulary, both types of Part D plans. Quality matters. People say quality matters a lot, and that's, of course, an issue in any type of plan. But really what we hear is that people do value choice, but they also value simplicity. And I think as you go and you talk to your friends and family and you are helping people that you know, simplicity is something that they think is a little bit far afield right now, and it's a little bit more difficult to make decisions than some people might hope. So hopefully today we will make things more simple and help bring some light to the topic.
Great. Thank you, Tricia. Let me just do a little of our traditional housekeeping. I'll be as brief as I can. There are lots of important pieces of information in your packets. As I said, a lot of them from the Kaiser Family Foundation and therefore top-notch. There'll be a video recording of this briefing available probably tomorrow, if not by Friday, on the Kaiser website, kff.org, and thanks very much to the foundation for arranging that. There'll be a transcript on our website, KFF. That's not it, is it?
Thanks for the plug.
Allhealth.org. In a few days. At the appropriate time, you can ask our panel a question by filling out one of the green cards in your packets, by coming to one of the microphones that you see, or by tweeting, if you will. The hashtag is MedicareOE. As in open enrollment. And if you need Wi-Fi, the instructions on how to connect are on your table, I believe. And if not, they are username house public, password house public. There you go. So We do indeed, as Tricia said, have a lot of experts besides her on this panel. Let me just give the briefest of mentions to our panel and then let them go at it. We'll start with Sean Kavanaugh, who's Deputy Administrator of CMS and Director of its Center for Medicare. He's going to give us the latest information about some trends in plan availability, in benefit design, in premiums and other costs. Then Gretchen Jacobson, Associate Director of the KFF Program on Medicare Policy, is going to talk to us about the trends in the Medicare Advantage MA program, factors like the stability of the number and quality of the plans available, changes in premiums and out-of-pocket limits, tendency of enrollees, as Tricia mentioned, to stick with their current MA plans. Then Jack Hoadley, who's a health policy analyst and researcher at Georgetown, is going to discuss what to expect in Medicare Part D prescription drug open enrollment, particularly the number of plans available, the cost trends, the coverage gaps, and low-income subsidies that are available. And then finally, Mark Hamelberg is a senior VP of federal programs at America's Health Insurance Plans, AHIP, is going to address some of the successes and challenges that are facing MA plans, including the high cost of drugs, the upcoming Medicare Part B premium changes, and the star quality rating system. So we've got some really terrific stuff coming at you, and we're going to start with Sean. Why don't I turn it over to you?
Thank you, Ed and Tricia. Thank you both for inviting me here today. I just have a few brief remarks before I turn it over to our panelists who've done some more intensive look at the programs. I'd just like to take everybody back a couple years. This summer, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid, but we're also celebrating the 5th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act. And if you recall, during the Affordable Care Act, a number of changes were made to the Medicare Advantage program, particularly around the funding of the program. And at the time, there was some controversy about what the effects would be and whether that was the end of Medicare Advantage as we know it. I'd just like to say it's worth looking at what's happened since those changes were made, because they contributed substantially to reducing the overall costs of the Medicare program. One thing we heard was that enrollment would drop, that plans would pull out. Well, as you'll hear from other panelists, enrollment in Medicare Advantage has grown every year since the Affordable Care Act has passed. Next year, we'll have over 17 million beneficiaries, almost one-third of all Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries will be enrolled in Medicare Advantage. We were told that access would be depleted, that certain areas of the country would not have access to Medicare Advantage, but in fact, 99% of all Medicare beneficiaries have access to at least one plan, and I think it's, don't quote me on this, but I think it's very close to 97 or 98% have access to more than one plan. There's also questions about what would happen to premiums, and there's going to be a little bit of disagreement here today what's happened with premiums, but essentially premiums are around at or below the levels they were prior to the Affordable Care Act. So premiums have remained affordable. Probably the most promising news since the Affordable Care Act was what's happened to the quality of care and the patient experience in Medicare Advantage. So in 2009, we had about 17% of all Medicare beneficiaries who were in MA plans were in 4- and 5-star plans. Our estimates are that in 2016, we'll have 70% of all beneficiaries in 4- and 5-star plans. So these are beneficiaries who are getting measurably better care and also reporting measurably better experiences with their care, which has always been one of the promises of the Affordable Care Act and one of the goals of CMS. So how do you achieve all this? Well, could it have been achieved at the detriment of benefits? Well, when we look at the supplemental benefits, it looks as if plans are offering around the same level of vision, dental, and other supplemental benefits. So in many ways, the programs have been doing great, both Part D and Part C, and the Affordable Care Act was able to generate significant savings and reduce significant federal overpayments while improving the plan and the choices for beneficiaries. But that does not mean all is well. Both the Medicare Advantage and the prescription drug program face significant challenges. Despite the changes made in the Affordable Care Act, we still believe that Medicare somewhat overpays Medicare Advantage plans. I think The latest estimate from MedPAC was that there's about 3% extra payment due to coding intensity. So to the degree we overpay Medicare Advantage plans, when beneficiaries move from fee-for-service into Medicare Advantage, it means it's increasing the costs to the federal government. It's increasing costs to the trust funds. And interestingly, also increasing Part B premiums for all Medicare beneficiaries. So that's a challenge and one we've been trying to address by taking different strategies to reduce the overpayments due to coding intensity. On the Part D side, as I said, the story on the beneficiary premiums is very good in that beneficiaries have faced fairly stable premiums. I wish the same was true as the program as a whole. In fact, Medicare is paying more for the program because largely driven by very high-cost specialty drugs. The per capita costs in the Part D program grew by 8% last year at a time when the total program costs of Medicare per capita were probably around 1%. In 2015, the actuaries are predicting the per capita expenditures for Part D will grow 15%. Now, the actuaries in the out years have all this moderating somewhat, but clearly high-cost specialty drugs are a real challenge to the continued viability of the stability of the Part D program. So stepping back from those statistics, I think a number of us are going to repeat similar things, and I just want to repeat some of the things that Tricia said. One of the ways we make these programs work better is for beneficiaries to be engaged and to really understand their choices. There are many dimensions. The one that we like beneficiaries to focus on that often doesn't get the focus is the star ratings, the quality measures, so they can choose plans according to that. There are many aspects, as Tricia pointed out, to the cost side. The premium is the easiest to quantify, but there are significant out-of-pocket costs in both programs, and beneficiaries should focus on that. The networks are important, and understanding if your doctor's in. Networks have become important on the Part D side as well, as Part D plans start creating preferred pharmacy networks, so a beneficiary's out-of-pocket costs will vary significantly. What we see and what you'll hear is that shopping pays benefits. It pays benefits for the beneficiary in that they can significantly save money if they shop. But shopping by beneficiaries also helps the programs. To the degree beneficiaries show they're willing to shop, willing to move based on cost, quality, and access, the more the plans in both programs will have to compete on all those measures. To the degree beneficiaries choose a plan and stay with it regardless of these changes, the less effective the competition is. So, as I said, a lot of great news in both programs, a lot of things to celebrate. And I think beneficiaries are celebrating it by increasingly choosing these programs, but significant challenges ahead. With that, wrap up my comments.
Go ahead, Gretchen.
It's terrific to be able to be here today. Thank you. I will provide an overview of what people need to know about Medicare Advantage as we enter the Medicare open enrollment period. So enrollment in Medicare Advantage is at an all-time high. It has tripled over the past decade, increasing from 5.6 million people in 2005 to 16.8 million people in 2015. Today, almost a third, 31% of people on Medicare, are enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans. This increase in enrollment, as Sean said, has been watched closely by many since 2010, because as a result of the Affordable Care Act, payments were gradually reduced to plans over time. And as Sean mentioned, during the debate of the Affordable Care Act, many speculated that plans may exit the market as a result of these reductions in payments and lead to reductions in enrollment over time. Instead, to the surprise of many, enrollment has increased each year since the enactment of the ACA. While almost a third of people on Medicare are enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans, as you can see here, enrollment varies widely across the country. In some places, such as Baltimore, enrollment is far below the national average. However, in other places, such as Portland, Oregon, or Miami, Florida, more than half of people on Medicare are enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans. The variation in enrollment reflects the diversity of the markets, as well as the coverage decisions of people on Medicare. In 2016, the average person on Medicare will be able to choose from among 19 plans. This ranges from 21 plans on average in metropolitan counties to 11 plans in more rural counties, and is a slight increase from an average of 18 plans in 2015. The number of plans available dropped between 2009 and 2011 because many private fee-for-service plans exited the market as a result of new regulations that required these plans to form provider networks. However, since that time period, the number of plan choices available to beneficiaries has been relatively steady, and this trend will continue in 2016. A total of 2,001 plans will be offered to people on Medicare in 2016. This includes 259 new plans that will be available for the first time. Some of these new plans are offered by long-standing Medicare Advantage firms that are expanding their existing service areas. Other new plans would be offered by firms entering Medicare Advantage for the first time and include some established healthcare systems, such as Johns Hopkins, that are expanding into insurance, as well as some established insurance firms that have a lot of extensive experience with families and kids, but less experience with seniors. Additionally, 203 plans were available in 2015 will be exiting the market in 2016, which you can see here in the gray bars. Many of these discontinued plans attracted relatively few enrollees, and as a result, only 3% of people in Medicare Advantage plans in 2015 will not be able to stay in the same plan in 2016. As you can see in the light blue bars, most of the plans available in 2015 will continue to be available in 2016. Overall, Medicare Advantage markets in terms of plan participation and beneficiary choice appear to be relatively stable between 2015 and 2016. Premiums for Medicare Advantage plans have also been relatively stable since 2010. As you can see in the chart on the left, the average premiums for Medicare Advantage plans that include prescription drug coverage was $44 per month in 2010, $39 per month in 2011, and $38 per month in 2015. Average premiums, though, differ across the country. And as you can see in the chart on the right, while the average premium was $38 per month in 2015, this ranges from an average of $6 per month among enrollees in Florida to over $100 per month among enrollees in Massachusetts and Minnesota. This variation in premiums, again, reflects the diversity of the markets and also the variation in enrollment by plan type. Premiums also vary within a state because plans and the federal payments to plans vary by county. For example, in Los Angeles, enrollees pay an average of $2 per month, whereas in San Francisco, enrollees pay an average of $65 per month. And then similarly, in New York City, for example, enrollees pay an average of $18 per month, whereas in Albany, enrollees pay an average of more than three times that amount. Unlike premiums and plan availability, we have seen an increase in out-of-pocket limits for Medicare Advantage plans over the past few years. All Medicare Advantage plans are required to limit enrollees' out-of-pocket expenses for Part A and Part B in-network services. Traditional Medicare, on the other hand, does not have an out-of-pocket limit. And for some people, this out-of-pocket limit is a very attractive feature of Medicare Advantage plans. In 2015, the average out-of-pocket limit was over $5,000, which is a $700 increase from 2013. Importantly, the out-of-pocket limit does not include many costs that Medicare Advantage enrollees may incur. And these include cost sharing for Part D drugs, out-of-network care, extra benefits offered by the plan, and costs for care that's not covered by the plan. So while the out-of-pocket limit provides some financial protection for Medicare Advantage enrollees, it's important to remember that there are many costs that enrollees incur that are not included. So during this time of open enrollment, people have the opportunity to compare and switch plans. With Medicare Advantage plans, there are many features that differ across plans, which people should consider when choosing a plan. However, this is often much easier said than done. Premiums, like Sean said, are the easiest feature to compare, and they're readily available to people who are shopping around. Similarly, deductibles are relatively easy to compare. But as you can see at the other end of the spectrum in orange, provider networks are often difficult, if not impossible, to compare across plans. To do so, one would need to download all of the provider directories for each plan available in their area, then thumb through them to manually compare each plan. And if you remember from earlier, the average person on Medicare has access to 18 plans on average in 2015. So you can see how this would be quite a large task to undertake. The complexity in comparing plans is likely one reason why few people ever change plans once they make an initial choice. We conducted focus groups with seniors to find out how they selected their plan initially and why they've never changed plans. Overall, seniors told us that they found the process of choosing plans to be overwhelming, confusing, and frustrating. And you can see some of that frustration reflected in the quotes here. Many seniors said that if their plan is working for them, they're hesitant to try something new and would rather find workarounds for their current plan. However, despite the frustration in comparing plans, as will probably be reiterated by many people here, it's important for beneficiaries to really take advantage of the open enrollment period and see how their plan is changing and whether it's still the best fit for their healthcare needs. Thank you.
That's great.
I'll turn
it
over.
Okay, thank you. And thanks to the Alliance for inviting me to be part of this. And thank you to the Kaiser Family Foundation for supporting my work on this, and to my co-authors on this analysis, Tricia, who you've already met, and Juliet Kabansky of the Foundation, who's also here today. So it's really a team effort. So the story on Medicare Part D is that beneficiaries have fewer drug plans to choose from in 2016 than in 2015. I wrote the wrong number on the top of the slide, but still have a lot of choices. The average beneficiary has 26 standalone drug plans to pick from in 2016. That's down a little bit, but as I say, still a lot of choices, and the average beneficiary also has 16 Medicare Advantage drug plans to look at as well if they're willing to go and shift to the Medicare Advantage sides for all their benefits. The drop from 2015 to 2016 is mostly low enrollment plans, so it's not a lot of people affected by this change. Over the time, there's been a pretty steady drop in the number of plans available, and that's been a combination of mergers and acquisitions that have occurred in this business, some dropping of low enrollment plans, as I said again for this most recent year, and also the requirement that CMS imposed a few years back to make sure that the multiple offerings from a given company are meaningfully different from each other, so that when you have two plans to pick from the same company, they're actually something different to look at, and there's a real reason to pick. And so the market has been a bit consolidated on that basis. The premium story, as Sean mentioned, it's been a story of pretty flat premiums over a period of years. But we are projecting that the average Part D standalone drug plan, if nobody makes switches this year, will go up by 13%, 2015 to 2016. So we are, potentially for the first time in a number of years, looking at some higher premiums. Even if a bunch of people switch, and we already discussed the fact that there's not a lot of switching in this market, it's still likely to be the biggest jump in premiums in quite a few years. Some of this is certainly the fact that there are no more or very few now brand drugs that are switching to generics has been one of the drivers of the flat premiums over the last several years. Certainly the rise of some of the new expensive drugs is a factor in this. But there's also factors that I won't go into here, but we could come up in questions about the higher cost to Medicare that's going along simultaneous with these premium trends. But again, as Gretchen mentioned on the Medicare Advantage side, there's a lot of variation in Part D premiums by region around the country. And you can see here that the lowest premium in New Mexico is $30 a month. This is, again, averaged across all the plans offered in New Mexico. On the high end, New Jersey at $50 a month and Florida at $45 a month. We can't explain this very well. We've tried to look at some of the reasons why there's so much variation. Certainly some of it is probably going to do with usage, although the premiums, the payments to the plans are risk-adjusted, so that should be taking care of some of the health differences. And, of course, the prices of drugs really don't vary across the country, so this is not really being driven by the underlying cost of drugs. It has to be driven more by usage patterns and that sort of thing. So as you're seeing this increase this year and sort of how does it come down to the person, there's a lot of people who are looking at $60 premiums that a lot more than last year. But there's still, as you can tell on this graphic on the right-hand side for 2016, a lot of variation. There are still people whose premiums are projected to be under $20, and there are others projected to be over $60. So there's a lot of choice out there in this market that people can look at. Looking specifically at the increases, and I did find a typo on this, that dark orange bar should say increase of more than $10. We are seeing that 39% of beneficiaries, if they don't make a switch, are looking at a $10 a month increase in their premium. And again, this to me is sort of that signal to the beneficiaries, even though they shouldn't be focusing all on premiums, it's kind of a signal that they should start to think about whether moving to a new plan might be a good thing to do this year. Again, those increases vary a lot by region. And you can see on the one hand the state of Arkansas, where the average premium actually dropped by 1% from last year, to in the other extreme, Florida and Arizona, where premiums are up by more than 20% projected from what we're looking at. But again, it's really important not to just look at premiums. And here I want to call your attention to some of the other features that are changing. Deductibles. Plans have an option of including a drug deductible. The law specifies a maximum deductible, and that amount is adjusted based on the underlying cost of drugs. So there's an indexed increase, and it's actually the biggest increase we've seen since the program started in what the maximum allowable deductible is, from $320 to $360. It's also true that 2/3 of all the plans have deductibles, and that's more plans than have ever had deductibles before, and the vast majority of those plans use that maximum deductible. So there are going to be beneficiaries out there who didn't see a deductible before who are seeing a deductible for the first time if they stay in their current plan, and most of them will at least see some increase in their deductible, although some will continue to be in plans without a deductible. Cost sharing has also been evolving over the recent years. Unlike the private sector, we really see more tiers, more cost-sharing tiers in Part D plans than you typically do in private sector plans. So today, most plans use a five-tier structure where they have a preferred and non-preferred generic tier, they have a preferred and non-preferred brand tier, and then they have a specialty tier for drugs that under Medicare's rules have to cost at least $600 a month. And so people can find that their formularies and their plans have changed, that the tiers on which drugs are placed have changed, and they may also find some changes in the amount of cost sharing attached to those tiers. Because one of the trends we're also seeing is a trend towards more use of coinsurance instead of flat copays. So people are now paying a share of the cost of their drug, which if it's an inexpensive drug, will end up cheaper. But for some of the more expensive drugs, having to pay 25% or 40% of your particular drug is going to be more expensive than a flat copay. And a lot of beneficiaries like the flat copays because they're more predictable from month to month. I would also remind you that the structure of Part D has the infamous donut hole and then a catastrophic phase. So as people's drug use during the year moves on and their costs accumulate, their cost sharing will actually vary as it goes through those different phases. We know that the donut hole is being phased out thanks to changes made in the Affordable Care Act, but it won't be fully phased out till 2020. The other trend we've seen recently is a trend, and I think this was already alluded to a couple of times, towards tiered pharmacy networks. So whereas it used to be, if your pharmacy was in the networks, and most pharmacies are in the networks of most plans, that was it, that your cost sharing was going to be the same regardless of the pharmacy you went to. But starting around 2011, a lot of plans started instituting tiered pharmacy networks where there's one set of pharmacies where you pay lower cost sharing and a second set of pharmacies where your cost sharing is higher. Obviously, an incentive to go with those cost sharings that have the lower preferred cost, those pharmacies that have the lower preferred cost sharing. But one of the questions is, do beneficiaries understand that distinction? Do they have one of the pharmacies near them that offers that lower cost sharing? Are they willing to switch pharmacies in order to get that? So again, it's one of the elements that is important as people shop for plan options. And the differences in that cost sharing can vary a lot from plan to plan, but one example is a brand drug that might have had a $20 copay on the designated pharmacy might have a $33 copay in any other network pharmacy, or a generic that might have been $1 with one of the designated pharmacies may turn out to be $10 in one of the other pharmacies. So I wanted to briefly mention the low-income subsidy. Beneficiaries that qualify through Medicaid or through low incomes and assets can get this kind of a subsidy. And if they pick certain plans, they're able to get a zero premium. And what this map shows is that the states vary in how many of those are plans are available with the zero premium, from a low of 2 in Hawaii and 3 in Florida to 10 in a variety of other states that you can see on this map. And one of the things that we've looked at is how many of those low-income subsidized beneficiaries are already in one of those zero-premium benchmark plans and don't need to make any kind of change to maintain that zero premium, and how many of them are in a plan that's scheduled not to have a zero premium. And you can see the numbers here. Some of the people in this orange slice, the nearly 2 million LIS beneficiaries in this orange slice, will be reassigned automatically by CMS to a zero premium plan. That's probably about 1/4 of the people in this group. But as our numbers suggest, there's another 3/4 of that group who have chosen their own plan in the past and so have to make a decision if they want to maintain paying a zero premium. And finally, and this really mostly repeats things we've already been hearing, but people really can save money if they shop around. History says that they tend not to. Our analysis suggested that almost 9 out of 10 stay with the same plan from year to year, and even the ones facing large premiums, many of them stay put. Shoppers do need to look beyond the premiums at the drugs and what's covered on the plan's formulary, at the pharmacy networks, at the star ratings, and there are resources to help people do this, including the plan finder on Medicare.gov, which really allows people to put in their drugs and find out exactly what their drugs will cost and which plan will end up being cheapest. And with that, I'll stop.
And if you pass the clicker to Mark, we'll hear from him.
Thank you, Ed, and thanks to all for inviting me to be here. So what I thought I would do is start. And echoing Sean's remarks, I think there's going to be a little bit of overlap here, although a little bit different points of emphasis, perhaps. But I would start by highlighting some of the specific aspects of MA plans that should be important to beneficiaries as they decide, maybe not plan to plan so much, but at least the larger question of whether to go into the MA program at all or go into the fee-for-service program or stay there. And it's critically important, not just as an individual Benny from a total health policy perspective, because CBO estimates that in another 10 years we'll have 30 million people in MA plans, or around 40% of the population. So this is a big deal, and it's important, I think, for people to understand what MA plans provide. Now, they have the flexibility to offer benefits that fee-for-service does not cover, and these benefits as a whole, we believe, help enrollees access care, better manage their illness, and very importantly, and sometimes not entirely focused on, contribute to an overall better quality of life for people in these plans. And I give some examples on these slides, things like extra skilled nursing coverage, vision, hearing, and dental benefits, fitness benefits. There's a range of other services like in-home safety assessments, transport to physicians in non-emergency situations that fee-for-service covers. The list goes on and on. They can also have different and oftentimes lower cost sharing than original Medicare for services that are covered by the original Medicare program. And as Gretchen mentioned, very importantly, they can have, or they are required to have, annual out-of-pocket caps that fee-for-service does not have. And MA enrollees are mostly in plans where they're also getting their Part D coverage. And in many cases, that coverage is at very little or no extra premium cost to these enrollees. And for anyone who has tried to navigate the healthcare system for themselves or a family member, we know how complicated that can be, and there's a lot of what MA plans offer that can really be helpful in these difficult situations, whether it's care coordination, disease and case management, nurse helplines, integrating prescription drugs and medical benefits. These are some of the perhaps unsung things that you don't really think about until you really need them and you see what kind of benefits they can offer. And also, many plans have tools that address disparity in care for minorities, for low-income beneficiaries, and for other vulnerable populations. And they, again, run the gamut: health literacy programs, cultural competency initiatives with providers, outreach to community leaders, direct outreach to beneficiaries to encourage them to keep their medical appointments, and again, transport for non-emergency visits that in some communications can really make the difference to make sure somebody gets their benefits. On Part D, of course, there's not a fee-for-service comparison. I think Jack obviously went through in great detail the sorts of trends and key choice issues. I think I included this slide. I'm not going to go through the list of things here. I just think it's important for us as we talk through is to remember that the Part D program began 1106, so 10 years ago. And for any of those like myself, I was at CMS at the time, who were involved in the implementation of this program, to see that it is such a major success story at this point, 10 years later, is really gratifying. And I just wanted to remember, as we focus on the details, it's nice that it's become such a accepted part of the Medicare program that we can have such a granular discussion, but I don't want to miss the bigger picture there. On quality, echoing a point that Sean made, it's great to see that overall the enrollment of MA beneficiaries and plans that are earning at least 4 stars continues to increase. The additional point I just wanted to mention is that research, especially more recent research, does indicate that MA plans and their contracted providers are surpassing the fee-for-service program on several specific quality metrics. And even more broadly and more importantly, it's critical to remember that unlike the fee-for-service program, MA plans are accountable for quality of care, that they're extensively measured and they're compared to each other on a wide range of metrics, whether it's through accreditation, the star rating. There's an accountability there and an ability to assess the quality of care that you may be receiving that isn't present in fee-for-service. Sean hit on some of these challenges. I'd say we may have a slightly different perspective on some of these challenges, and maybe our lists don't exactly overlap, but on the rising drug price concept, I think many, including AHIP and our members, believe we've really, if not already there, we're just about at that critical point where we've got existing prescription drugs that are going up in price. We have products in the pipeline with really sky-high launch prices. And if you take into account the market exclusivity that many of these new products may have, you can have medications coming to market very, very expensive without a therapeutic alternative. And it just puts the program as a whole in a position where we're all very concerned that these trends are simply not sustainable over the long term. Now, at AHIP, we've been advocating for a number of things, including, at least as a first start, greater transparency around how prices are developed, and continued enforcement against unwarranted patent extensions by drug makers. And we're happy to talk more about this, but this is a huge, huge issue and something that requires, fortunately, it's now, I think, reached a tipping point where it's getting the sort of attention that it really requires. Star ratings for low-income beneficiaries. We, despite the overall increases in star ratings, which, of course, we're very happy to see, we have consistently raised concerns that the star rating system does systematically hurt and bias plans that focus on low-income beneficiaries. And that has implications, and implications for the benefits that enrollees in these plans can obtain. And it also is important because in terms of sending market signals about the quality of care that somebody might be looking at as they're shopping for coverage, it may not really tell the full story for the types of effort and successes that those plans are having in helping these vulnerable populations get access to care. And our research has shown that there's some bias, and I think some research that CMS very recently released on this, in our case, in our perspective, confirms that this is the case, at least for the specific adherence and other measures that they looked at. And we think it's really important that something be done to address these concerns. Lastly, on the question of ACA cuts and the health insurance tax, as I said, I think Sean and I might have a slightly different perspective on this. We believe that the data does show that there has been an effect from the cuts in the ACA. Now, we know that the cuts are almost fully phased in. We have another year to go for part of the counties. But it's also important to note that averages mask many of the variation that occurs in different locations, different geographies, different counties. I think Gretchen may have touched on that. So it's really critical when you're assessing the impact of these sorts of policy choices that given the way that the MA program is designed, that you don't just look nationally, don't just look at averages. You need to look at particular areas where people live. And on the health insurance tax, that isn't something that's phasing out. That's something that continues to grow and will be with us. And AHIP did analysis a few years ago through the firm Oliver Wyman, and they found that there was by 2023, we're expecting a very significant impact. I'm not seeing it right in my notes here, but it's something like as high as $42 per member per month impact from the health insurance tax alone in MA plans. So we're very, very concerned about the long-term implications of the health insurance tax and think it needs to be something that's addressed, put together both the insurance tax and the ACA cuts collectively. MA plans are doing many of the sorts of things that, as a policy matter, the Secretary and others have been pushing, and it's critically important that policies that are considered now and in the future be designed to try to encourage those activities and not discourage them. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you very much, Mark. As we mentioned, there are a number of different ways you can now join the conversation. There are the microphones here, and I apologize to you folks way down in the corner. One of the ways to get a better view is to come to the microphone and ask a question. You can also put write your question on a green card, or you can tweet to MedicareOE, hashtag. And can I start us off? I think, I guess it was no more than four panelists and a co-moderator who mentioned this business of trying to induce beneficiaries to look more closely at the choices that are available to them to account for the changing circumstances. Now, two things occurred to me. First, in the more general market, as affected by the ACA, you've got navigators and application assisters and agents. Are there parallel mechanisms for Medicare beneficiaries, and what are they and how effective are they? And second, one of the answers might be the answer to the first question, but how do we get people out of the mindset that shows up on Gretchen's slide of those quotes from the focus groups where, and understandably, they say, we've done all this work enough. So how do we get them? How do we make it easier to come to a rational conclusion on these issues? You all started it.
Okay, well, I started us off, so I'll put my finger in it again. Yes, there are health insurance counselors in every state that can help people if people know to go to them. But I would imagine, and I don't have the numbers, but I would imagine many people are unaware of state health insurance programs and fewer people use them. I think one of the issues is that people do find this overwhelming and they find it complicated and they get their big Medicare and You book and they go, wow, that's a lot of information. And what they tell us is that they keep it because they think it looks really important, but they don't want to open it because it looks so boring. And so then they go, then they get stuff from all the plans, but they're already in a plan. And what they told us in the focus groups is they sort of think the plans are basically the same. They think they might end up worse off if they make a change. I know they do get an annual, so I'm going to turn an answer into a question, which is such a nice way of pushing it down the table. I know there's an annual notice of change. But my question is how customer specific is it? Because, so for example, my mom gets told there's an annual notice of change and she can go look for it if she goes online. But I don't think she gets, hey, your drug number one is going to be shifted to tier three. And if that means you're going to, instead of paying this year, this next year, because that would shake her up. And if it were patient-specific or customer-specific, I think that might motivate action more than we're changing our tier structure. And, you know, you might look on a piece of, you might go online and find out which pharmacies are in our network, which just seems vague and not motivational.
So it's true, not all the information is tailored individually as it could be. I wanted to make a different point, though. So I took over my current position about a year and a half ago when we were going through this process, and people were saying, oh, the number of MA plans by community is down from 35 to 30. What's wrong with the program? And I was new to it, and I was like, 30 seems like a lot. I can't imagine choosing among 30 anything, much less things that vary on all the parameters that we've just walked through. So I think one of the questions that I get from beneficiaries is, you know, can't you simplify this? Or why are there so many plans? Can't you simplify it? CMS has done some, and one of it was referenced, which is if a company's going to offer multiple plans, they have to be meaningfully different. Because I do think we had plans out there that didn't add a lot of value and just made the choices much more harder. The answer I give, and I mean, we all fall back on anecdotes about our parents, is I point out to my father the great lengths he goes to save 30 cents per gallon on gas. I was like, you can spare 2 hours to save, you know, several hundred dollars on your health insurance. And when you frame it like that, and then you show up and help, you can get them to do it.
I was just going to add, I mean, I think it's a challenge really to all of us to figure out how to make the notices that go out, either specifically the annual notice of change, which is a particular document that plans have to send out to say what's changed that Tricia was referring to, but even more generally, the kinds of notices that go out, how to put them in a language, in a form, while obviously having to conform with all the legal necessities that CMS has to do, that'll make people notice that, hey, there's a reason to do that. I'll give a brief plug to a stakeholder group that the National Council on Aging has convened with stakeholders ranging from beneficiaries to drug manufacturers to plan. We've been focusing particularly on the Part D side to try to think about a number of issues, including how to get the notices better. And, of course, one of the things we've discovered, it's hard. But I think it's something that a lot of people need to give attention to. you know, what are the ways we can get people's attention to really get them to start thinking about these things?
And I'll just add that, you know, over the course of the years, and it's not just the Medicare program, but it plays out over and over and over again, there's always a tension between how much information is necessary versus how much information is too much information, and if everything is important, then nothing is important. And that sort of ability to focus on what is critically important to most people is something that I think the government has struggled with for many, many years, and I think this is just a function of that.
Can I just ask as a follow-up? Nobody in this discourse mentioned the plan finder, and I wonder if that is, if somebody could explain what it is, first of all, and assess whether it's really something that can be of any help.
All right, I'm going to give a plug to the Plan Finder, even though, you know, there are issues with it, but it is the only place where you can go to compare all the Medicare Part D plans based on the specific drugs that you take, the dose levels, your pharmacy preference. So it is sort of an awesome resource and the only one like it that I know of that is available to people on Medicare who want to compare and choose their plans. Can it be improved? Yeah, definitely. But it's a pretty great resource. The problem is, I don't know how many of our moms, grandmoms, aunts, and uncles want to go on and spend the time to do it. Even though Sean's right, they're you know clipping coupons for other things. But this isn't that much fun. It's hard to do.
I would just also add that it's unfortunately not very useful for comparing Medicare Advantage plans because it's missing a lot of those really difficult features that are. Differ across Medicare Advantage plans like provider networks. It's just not feasible at this point to include that in the Medicare Plan Finder.
Yeah, I would do two things. One, to say put a plug in for Plan Finder, and as Patricia said, or the panelists said, it's much stronger on the Part D side than the Part C side, though it's still a really good place to start for any of this. The other thing I'd say is typically, and it happened today, when I come to meetings like this, people come up to me with ideas on how to improve Plan Finder. And typically, and it happened today, I say, great, can you get me the money to do it? We've got a long list of improvements. It's a really good tool that could be much, much better, and we hope to get funds to invest in it someday because I do think it could enhance what I said, which is I think beneficiaries shopping intelligently, making better choices for themselves, is actually not just good for them, it's better for the program as well.
I'll just make a plug also. You've got 1-800-MEDICARE. You've got plan call centers. There are lots of places. It may not provide the full panoply of every choice in one place, but it could be an iterative process. And also, as somebody, again, as Sean mentioned, who's and Trish as well, has done this for parents, you can winnow a list and then use other ways, whether it's through call center, Plan Finder, or other places to find the choice that you think is best for you.
Okay. Yes, John? John, you want to identify yourself?
Yes.
And
I'm John Green with the National Association of Health Underwriters. I represent health insurance agents and brokers. And we are trained.
Hang on just a second. Is there any way to make that microphone work? Yeah.
Okay. Is this better?
Much better.
Okay.
You sound terrific.
Thank you. So, again, John Green, National Association of Health Underwriters, represent health insurance agents and brokers, not mentioned among the panelists. As a resource, we are trained and certified to sell these plans. Our people are local. They're kitchen table people. They know what the networks are. I put in a plug for the Drug Finder, too. My members use it extensively for Part D. There are some problems with C. But again, they know what the networks are like, and they always reevaluate all their clients' plans each year because health status change, incomes change, medications change, the tiering issues. They're looking to put them in, place them properly in a plan that is efficient but costs less. So I just want to put in a plug for us. We signed up 40% of all enrollees in the private exchanges. So we've been doing this for many decades. Our senior agents are actually older themselves and very experienced. So I put in a plug for using an agent. It doesn't cost the consumer anything. Carriers pay us a commission to do it. And that book of business has value, so providing good service is important from year to year. Thanks.
Okay. Very good. You want to pick up some of the many questions that have come in?
There are several questions about switching. One is, if only about 10% switch plans on an annual basis, who are they? What's their motivation? Can we get more information about who switches and why to encourage more of it? Do we know how many people switch Medicare Advantage plans each year? And I think those are all I can batch together on the issue of switching. Anybody can take those?
Talk a little bit about the switching. You know, the study that we've done on the Part D side can identify how many switched. We're using Medicare administrative data to do that analysis, so we don't have information on their motivations. We know some of that from other sources. I mean, we can see that when the premium increase from one year to the next is greater, more people switch than when they don't see a lot of change in premium. So clearly some of it is motivated by those kinds of things. But it's a lot harder to know what really convinces people to start the process. I think, you know, once they start the process, they're going to be driven to move by premiums and all these other kinds of things. I think it's what gets them past all the things you've heard, which is, oh, this is complicated, too confusing, leave well enough alone, everything's probably about the same. And I think the thing that we're really struggling with is how to get people's attention.
The only thing I would add to that is, and I apologize, I don't have the number of switchers, but Jack's slides presented a 13% increase in the Part D premium, and he, I think, accurately portrayed that if no one switched. The fact is, not enough people switch, but people do switch. And so the reason Medicare, well, there's a couple differences between the numbers CMS released this year and Jack's, but one of which is we base it on historical experience of how many and who switches. And so that premium increase in actuality, we think, will be much, much lower. So there is some switching, but it shows you how powerful switching can be, because it would bring that 13% number down into the 3 to 4%. And that's with an inadequate number of people switching. So imagine the power of many, many more people voting with their feet.
Sean, is that somehow the idea that if I'm remembering the statistic quoted by our panelists is accurate, 10% switch, and that's going to make that big of a difference in that increase?
Yes, because it's a very skewed 10%. It's not a representative sample. It's mostly, as Jack said, people who see a very significant premium increase. Not everybody who sees a significant premium increase. Too many of them stay put, but the ones who do move tend to be at that high end of the spectrum.
Yeah, there's certainly the potential. I mean, some of those people in my slide that are up projecting a $60 or higher premium, they've also got a $20, an under $20 plan. If we had a lot of people switching from a 60 to a 20, even a relatively small number of people switching to 20, that's sort of the leverage that you talk about. And it's also, and I think Sean alluded to this earlier, it's an important signal to that market, because to the extent that people don't switch, those plans that are at the high premium levels are going to tend to go ahead and raise their premium. If they think they're at risk for losing people when they raise their premium, they're going to think harder about how to set their premium, what they need to do to manage their cost in order to offer a lower premium product. So it's a signal to the market as well.
I would also just to quickly add some information that we got from our focus groups. Many of the people that we heard in our focus groups who had switched plans were people who had friends, families, agents, brokers, people that actually helped them to switch plans and to look at all the various plans. So it seemed that sort of having that help really motivated people to switch. And then additionally, we also heard from many people that they assumed that if their plan was increasing prices, that was just part of a general trend and that all plans were increasing prices. So it really took a big change to get people to stop and look and see if there was something else.
Okay. There's a study, and I'm not sure who ought to respond to this first, but there's a study in the October issue of Health Affairs that concludes that Medicare beneficiaries tend to leave private MA plans for traditional Medicare when their health declines. If that's true, why do you think it happens, and what are the implications for both the program and patients? Mark, you want to take a crack at that first?
Sure, I'm happy to start. Yeah, we did take a look at that study, and I have a couple of thoughts, both a little bit more technical and a little bit broader. Starting with the technical, as I understand it, the study was looking at a very specific point in time, 1 year, people from 2010 to 2011, and seeing where they started and where they ended up. And really, most of the change that they were noting dealt with duals, dual eligibles, and specifically are primarily dual eligibles going to nursing home care. Okay? So it seems to me, first and foremost, what the article is sort of raising the question, is there something intrinsically concerning about MA plans providing coverage to people when they, are going into nursing homes or having these other conditions? And I think first and foremost, you can easily see that there are lots of reasons why, as somebody has moved into a nursing home, particularly long-term nursing home, that they might disenroll from an MA plan, they might move out of a service area. Sort of the last thing on people's minds, especially because you have, as a dual, you have a lot of flexibility in your enrollment rights. It's sort of, there may be other things that are causing them, at least given the particular points in time that they're looking at, that might have shown why these statistics were what they were for that population. Also, as I said, it's only 1 year of data, okay? So it seems to me, before you have a trend that should be really concerning, you need to look at more than one particular year. Also, I think, given some of the, the overall disenrollment rates, as we said, are very, very low. So within a very specific subpopulation, having, sort of going in one direction being different than another, it's still a very low disenrollment rate or from MA to fee-for-service. If this was really a significant issue, I think you'd see much broader movement of people, and you're not seeing it. And also, even the study, they recognize there have been changes in the program since 2010 that aren't really reflected in the study that might have an impact. And more broadly, again, sort of the last broad point is that we have lots of studies that show that duals and others are getting good quality care in MA plans. And if there was something really problematic with this study, or that this study was uncovering something really problematic, you wouldn't be seeing those data. So I guess I did take a look at it, so I hope that's helpful.
Anyone else want to weigh in?
Just briefly, I'd say we are continuing to look at it. Our fear, though not our conclusion, is either the plans are doing something wrong, so that when someone gets sick, they don't want to take care of them anymore, or that we, the agency, are doing something wrong, meaning we're not paying appropriately for sick beneficiaries. And so we've been reexamining our risk adjustment to make sure we're properly paying for high-cost folks, and we're trying to understand the study better to see if the plans are doing anything wrong, but we certainly haven't drawn any conclusions on either of those.
The only thing I would add, which isn't so much to the specifics of this study, but to the extent as people, accumulate illnesses and accumulate health conditions, the Medicare Advantage plans that have restrictive networks is more likely to bump into people's concerns. So if somebody's trying to, as they accumulate more illnesses, is now needs a cardiologist and a rheumatologist and an allergist and several other kinds of specialties, they could, and I'm not saying they do, but they could run into more issues around network choices, and that could lead some of them back to traditional Medicare. And so that's maybe the one thing that's a little more systematic that this could be picking up.
I'm just going to add one small point, which is I think one of the populations we haven't talked about today are the people who are on Medicare, almost 10 million people on Medicare who are under 65 and have permanent disabilities. And I think that's a group whose experience is not well understood in Medicare Advantage plans. And I think that is, given their enrollment rates are a bit lower than the elder than people who are older, but I think given their numbers and given the important role that Medicare Advantage plans are playing, it's really important to understand how well these plans are serving this population because their needs are not necessarily the same as those who are 65 and older.
Mark, you talked about, I don't mean to be picking on you, but you put the stuff in your slides, so how can I resist? You talked about the Part B premium increase for part of the population, I guess, what, maybe 15 million people, 30% of beneficiaries,
right,
are facing the possibility of a 50% or more increase in their Part B premium. And I wonder, who these people are, why they're facing such a steep increase. I understand deductibles are going to go up about the same amount. State Medicaid programs are going to be affected. What are we to make of this, and what should we be thinking about as options?
Well, I'm happy to start. Sean might be the right person to really get the perspective on where the administration might be going with this.
No, it's all yours, Mark.
Well, if you're giving me your proxy as to what the solution's going to be,
sure.
So I think it's worth raising just at least as a start because it could affect people's decision-making now and possibly in the future. And folks may have seen that at least the Board of Trustees had previously estimated, and we don't know for sure what they're going to decide to do, but the way that the law is written, that there's a hold harmless provision essentially for beneficiaries that prevents Part B premiums from going up and ties it to when Social Security payments aren't going up. But about 30% of the population is not protected by this hold harmless provision. And it includes newly eligible beneficiaries who haven't, or those who otherwise haven't been paying premiums through Social Security withhold. You've got duals who are not protected. And obviously duals themselves are typically not affected by it, but state programs that would subsidize their coverage are affected by it. And this isn't just a premium issue, it's also a deductible issue as well. But for the deductible, it's not a hold harmless issue. I mean, I believe everybody is affected by the increase in deductible.
You're talking about the Part B deductible.
Yes, thank you, the Part B deductible. Now, for almost all people in MA plans, they are paying the Part B premium. Now, for many of them, they have what are known as zero premium plans. They're not paying anything extra. But they pay the Part B premium, and if you are deciding to go into Original Medicare, you've got to decide whether to get a Medigap policy. Some of these changes, especially the increase in deductible, can affect that. So I'm not giving any particular solutions because Sean's the one to ask about that, but I think I think people are very, very concerned that for this large group, 30% estimated of the population, they could see a very significant monthly increase in the deductible, or in the Part B premium, and an increase in the deductible. And that obviously can have an impact, as we're sitting here a day before open enrollment, an impact on how people decide what program they want to go into.
Yeah, so I would just add, Mark did a very good job explaining it. The one step before is the actuaries found that Medicare Part B expenses are growing faster than they previously predicted. They're still growing very slowly by historical standards, but they are growing more quickly than they had previously built into their estimates. Therefore, there's been the Part B trust fund has what's called a margin, a surplus in it, and there's been some erosion of that margin. So they need to they identified a need to raise the premium, in part to cover those higher costs, in part to rebuild the margin. When they did that, it happened to be a year, as Mark said, where 70% of beneficiaries are protected from any Part B premium increase. So if you need to raise a certain amount of money from 55 million beneficiaries, but three quarters, 70% of them are exempt from paying it, the amount you need to collect from the others essentially almost quadruples. So whatever premium increase would have otherwise been needed, it needs to go up by much, much more. Mark correctly identified the populations. I would just point out the largest of the 16 million or so is the duals, who don't actually pay premium increases. It's the states. So it's a very significant, probably unbudgeted expense that the states would have to come up with in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 billion if something weren't fixed. So the populations are the duals. A number of people who don't qualify for Social Security benefits, like if anybody, probably no one here is old enough, but the old CSRS, Federal Retiree System, some other public retirees, anybody paying the income-related premium, and as Mark correctly pointed out, the newly eligible beneficiaries.
Another group are people who have been advised to delay Social Security, so people who are age 65 or older who are waiting to get their full retirement benefits, and a lot of them get good financial advice that says, hey, wait as long as you can because this will increase your benefits over the rest of your life. They, too, will be affected, and they're not necessarily a higher-income group of people. So to sort of close the loop, I think next step is Social Security is going to announce or is scheduled to announce no cost-of-living adjustment tomorrow, and then everybody kind of waits for the secretary to announce what her determination will be as to the premium increase and the deductible increase. She may have some flexibility in determining adequate contingency reserves, but that still may result in a pretty big increase in the projected premium and the deductible, which then brings the discussion back to this building and this part of town, because any other option for reducing the growth in premiums and deductibles for the 30% would require a change in law.
Yeah, I just want to accentuate that last point. So when the secretary makes her decision, there's only two ways money gets into the Part B trust fund. One is the secretary sets the premium, and then that triggers 3-to-1 matching payments from the Treasury. But so if she gets it wrong, meaning if she sets a premium too low and expenses exceed revenues next year, there is no mechanism to fix that other than a change in law. So Congress would have to intervene, meaning the secretary has to be very careful and wise when she sets the premium.
The only other thing I would add, in sort of putting this in a slightly longer-term context, you know, the division of Medicare into Part A and Part B, you know, which is a historical artifact in a sense of 50 years standing, we're in a situation where a lot of care is shifting from the hospital, Part A, to non-hospital Part B services, and so Part A being funded by the payroll tax, Part B being funded through this premium and general revenues, means even if Medicare costs as a whole are being level, flat, low increases, whatever, there may be the shift into Part B, and that's something that a lot of people have said at some point down the line needs to be rethought, and that sort of plays into this debate, not for this year's particular problem, but as we think about potential for this to reoccur in future years.
We had a couple of questions about low-income program. Jack, you touched on this, and I wonder if you could take, 45 seconds to describe what the low-income assistance really consists of. And there's another question that
there are so few plans in Florida,
benchmark plans that qualify people for the best deal on the low-income assistance.
So the low-income subsidy in Part D, Part D is unusual in Medicare in a number of ways that we've talked about, being delivered only by private plans being the most obvious one. But another one is that there is a subsidy built into the Medicare program for the drug benefit, unlike Part A and Part B benefits, where the subsidies come through Medicaid, not directly through Medicare. You get that subsidy in Part D, and there's about 11 million beneficiaries who are eligible for those or who get those subsidies, either through already being a dual eligible or through applying based on income and asset levels. And what you get for that is a zero premium as long as you pick one of the benchmark plans in your region. You also get far reduced copays for most of them, no deductibles, and no donut hole, and a true out-of-pocket cap. So there's a lot of good things that this creates for you, and most of those good things don't matter what plan you're in. For the premium in particular, there's a calculation CMS makes each year to set a benchmark at a region, which is based on the average premium submitted, and then it's sort of the arithmetic that leads to a situation like Florida that says, you know, where the benchmark landed and how many plans land above or below it. And so it's a little hard to do a why. We've seen different states be in that situation where they have fewer plans below the benchmark, but the benchmark is set separately for each region. So it is a regionally specific benchmark. And then what happens is if you happen to be in one of those plans, and we have seen a lot of volatility from year to year in which plans qualify under the benchmark in a given region, but if you're in one of those plans that qualified last year, so you got your zero premium, and it doesn't qualify anymore this year, depending on your circumstances, and this is more than 45 seconds already, but depending on your circumstances, CMS may reassign you, and that's basically if you were putting that plan in the first place by CMS. But if you took the trouble to pick a plan, even though you may have done it with the help of somebody else, then you're considered a chooser, and you don't get reassigned. And so there's a lot of people now over the years who are in that category who don't automatically get reassigned. They get a letter that says, hey, here's a list of all the zero premium plans, but if you don't read that letter and you don't act on that letter, you stay in that plan. And we know there are some beneficiaries who are low income by definition because they're getting that subsidy who are paying premiums that are not as high. They still get some assistance with that premium. But there are people who are paying $50, $60, $80, $100 a month for people that really shouldn't be able to afford that. And again, it's like the question of getting people to switch. How do you get this particular population who has the option for a zero premium to pay attention and switch? The only other caveat I would add is for some of them, like everybody else, it may not always be that the zero premium plan is the best for them. In some cases, it's worth them paying $5 or $10 in premium to get more of their drugs covered. So it doesn't necessarily mean that because somebody's paying zero, that's why we don't automatically switch those people, or CMS doesn't automatically switch those people. So like everything else, it's complicated, but it does seem like there are people who could be better off, and the question is how to get them there.
Could I ask, we're down to less than 10 minutes of our scheduled time, and if I could ask you to take a look at that blue evaluation form as we go through these last couple of questions and try to give us some feedback on how we can improve these programs. We're particularly interested in those of you who are congressional staff to give us the feedback about how you might be able to use the information. I've got a couple of really straightforward questions, not quite so philosophical. Nobody really talked, we were talking about Part D pharmacy networks, and there are two aspects of that that triggered questions in my mind. One is no one talked about mail order, which is a daily fact of this Medicare beneficiary's life. And I wonder whether, as people have constructed these networks, they've done it in a way that parallels the controversy that we've been seeing in health insurance of, quote, narrow networks. Someone asked the question, are you able to get to one of these network pharmacies and get the lower deductible or the lower copay?
So on the mail order side, mail order is used a lot less in Medicare Part D than in commercial plans. There is some mail order use, and people in most cases are able to get access to mail order, but because of the way the rules around Part D is structured, there's less ability for a plan to create incentives to get people to use mail order, and I think that's one of the reasons you haven't seen as much of the use. I think a lot of people, you know, are creatures of habit for all the reasons we've been talking about. So if they've been using their community pharmacy, they're going to stay there. And if the plan isn't able to create some kind of incentive to move them to mail, they can't. There are good reasons on both sides of whether you should or shouldn't allow those kinds of incentives. I think on the narrow pharmacy network, if you look at the pharmacy networks as a whole, there's generally a kind of an any willing pharmacy rule that applies in Medicare. So the networks as a whole tend to have most pharmacies in them. Most plans have most pharmacies in their network. And so consumers don't generally have a problem. Where the problem has arisen is in the tiered networks. And CMS has done some studies and put out some notices to the plans identifying that some plans seem to have so few pharmacies in that sort of preferred tier of their pharmacy network that a lot of people may have trouble having one that's convenient to them. Yep, and I don't know, Sean may want to say more about this, but CMS has taken some efforts to try to both put plans on alert to try to sort of make sure the preferred tier sector of their pharmacy network is more robust, but also more information on the plan finder. Changes were made to the plan finder a while back to make sure people put their pharmacies in, and so when they get a price, it's based on their pharmacy's price, but to try to flag these situations where maybe there isn't a convenient preferred pharmacy.
Jack is correct that when we noticed the proliferation of these preferred networks, our first concern was whether beneficiaries actually had access to them. And so you could imagine a situation where they're enticed into a plan with promise of very low cost sharing and then find that the preferred pharmacies where that cost sharing is available is not available to them or is difficult to reach. We did a study, and the findings were actually very reassuring, which is that most of the preferred networks actually have very good availability to the vast majority of beneficiaries. We did identify a few outliers where the opposite was true, where very, very few beneficiaries had access. We've worked with a number of those plans to increase their networks. I would say there was one that was reluctant to increase their networks, and we worked with them instead to make sure they more fully disclose that to beneficiaries, which is, you know, just make sure they understood what they were getting into, that the network was very restricted. But it is an interesting phenomenon. There's been a lot of controversy around this, but our study did show that the networks were fairly well available to most beneficiaries.
And if I could just add, it's just I think the plans and with the what they're seeing for the beneficiaries is the ability to use these preferred pharmacy networks to really offer cost-effective coverage, and particularly with some of the other trends that we've talked about earlier, it's just critically important and that's why you're seeing an increase in the use of these approaches.
On the topic of networks, we seem to know a lot about the networks of the Part D plans. What do we know, maybe for Gretchen or Mark or Sean? What do we know about the Medicare Advantage networks? I'll just leave it at that. What do we know about Medicare Advantage networks?
I'm happy to answer, but if you want to go first.
Okay.
So in recent years, some plans have moved to more of a narrow network approach, which has caused some disruption for beneficiaries. We've tried to be even-handed about this because we try to encourage things that improve quality and efficiency of the plans. But we're also interested in the beneficiary first. So we have regulations. We've done two things. One was made sure the plans know they need to notify us if they're making significant changes in their network, particularly during the year, so we can determine whether beneficiaries are affected in a meaningful way and whether they need or should be entitled to a special enrollment period. So you can imagine you joined a plan because your doctor was in it, you got halfway into the year and your doctor was no longer in it. So when we're aware of those situations, we try to allow the beneficiary a special enrollment plan. The other thing we've done is we had really been only enforcing our network adequacy requirements when there were changes, meaning a plan wanted to expand into new counties or something. We are now moving towards more regularly checking the adequacy of networks. Having said that, I think, you know, these automated network adequacy and network monitoring tools that we have are imperfect at best, and it's difficult to be sensitive to all the regional differences in what an adequate network is. One of the things we've been working with both within CMS, but I know the industry's been working with, is making sure that provider directories, for example, are timely and accurate and up to date. it's very difficult, but from the agency's perspective, it's absolutely essential because, as I've often said, that's what they're selling. They're selling a network. That's the product, and the beneficiary ought to always know what the product is. Having said that, I know the industry struggled working with physician offices about keeping the information up to date. That's a long answer to, we know a lot but never enough about the networks. It's an essential topic because I really think that's an essential part of the product that the industry's selling and the beneficiary's buying.
And I would just add that there's just so much that we do not know about Medicare Advantage networks. We don't know how many of them are ultra-narrow networks, how many of them are broad, whether they're mostly broad, mostly narrow, whether they tend to include academic medical centers. There's just so much we just have no clue about with Medicare Advantage networks because it's really, really difficult to dig underneath and actually compare the networks.
I'll just add that I might quibble a little bit with the notion of an ultra narrow because, as Sean indicated, there's still an overlaying network adequacy requirement. So it's really, there may be gradations of breadth of networks, but they still, plans must comply with the overarching network adequacy requirements.
Well, go ahead.
No.
We have come to the end of our time, and I don't know about you, but I learned an awful lot in the last hour and 45 minutes about these issues, and I want to thank our friends at the Kaiser Family Foundation, not just for joining us in putting this event together, but contributing so richly to the quality of the discourse. I'd like to thank our panel and ask you to join me in helping to thank the panel for what I think was a very enlightening conversation. Take some back.